Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
I think when I was young, you know, you always have kids that are like, oh, I want to be a police officer when I grow up. I always wanted to be a dog handler because I love dogs, but the way I look after my dog, I'd be too soft. Like, that dog would probably get overweight and just not be as strict as
they're
it
really
should be.
They're really scary, our police dogs.
Yeah, so. Yeah, they
I
are,
wouldn't
want to
go anywhere near them.
But like, I just know that I'd want to cuddle it and stuff, and you can't do that with a police dog. So evidently that career route
Although
was
Although we
not
do have
me.
A very nice well-being dog who's very fluffy and lovely.
Welcome back to another episode of Girls Know Nothing. For those that have been following me personally on social media, will have known that I've been working with Thames Valley Police for almost a year now. And what a fitting way to celebrate that anniversary, to not just have one, but have two serving officers in my studio today. Katie Barragrant is a Chief Superintendent in Thames Valley Police and is the most senior female police officer with almost 20 years of experience in the police force. Katie also has an academic interest in domestic abuse, completing her master's at Warwick Business School, and has written on domestic abuse rates in the criminal justice system. Katie is currently the strategic lead for violence against women and girls across the force. We also have Amy Howard, who is a detective sergeant in Thames Valley Police. In the new rape and sexual offences team, a team of detectives dedicated to improving the outcomes for survivors of rape and sexual offences. Amy also has 20 years of experience and is focused on improving the services for victims and has also just received her long service medal. Welcome to the studio, guys. That was Thank a very you. Long introduction, isn't it? Trying to get both of your like achievements in.
Feels it.
It's yeah. as long as your career is. So you don't look old enough to have worked in the police force for 20 years, so... No.
Thank you.
Good. Flattery gets you everywhere, guys.
So it probably wouldn't get me out of trouble if I ever was in one.
No, absolutely not.
No. I tried. Do you know what, actually? One thing that I found really surprising when I started working with Thames Valley Police on like social content and learning a bit more about what you guys as a force do is the amount of women that have approached me randomly to be like, I love this because I want to join the police and I get more of an insight into what you do. I think the weirdest one that stuck in my memory is at 6 o'clock in the morning in Costa drive-through. Like the girl that worked there, she was in college still, stuck her head out the window and was like, I really want to be a police officer. And I was like, okay, I really want my coffee. That's great. So I think it's really nice to like actually have, like to know that there is like people watching and are like, now inspired by their future career choices based off like what we've done together. But what inspired your kind of decision to want to become police officers or join the force? Either one of you guys, you know?
So my mum would always say it was actually the murder of Jill Dando. She said that happened when I was a teenager. And she says I was quite affected by that. I don't really remember it. But then I went to university and studied sociology and criminology. And I started studying girl gangs and why women got involved in gang activity. And that just piqued my interest in policing and kind of criminology. And then I saw an advert for the police and applied, and here I am. So no policing history in my background, in my family or anything. So I'm the first.
I'm probably the polar opposite. Yeah, so there's policing history in my family, my uncle, grandfather. And for me, it's from when I was thinking about what job I was going to do, it was always the police. I always wanted to be in the police, either that or a teacher. Did work experience in both, and the police one. yeah, just something I've always wanted to do. So from university, that was where I went to after that.
Is it the children that put you off teaching?
I did quite like the children to be, and then I've gone on to work in child abuse. So I think it's there as well, you know. But yeah, it's just always been in me wanting to do the job that I do, and I love it.
I always find it really interesting hearing the reasons as to why people join the force, because everybody I've always spoken to is they have a relation
right
to it. So like for me, it's really interesting to hear your side, as if you've seen like a case and that it kind of inspired you. What would you have said the biggest challenges were for you as female officers joining the force?
I didn't find being a female officer in the force a challenge. And I haven't found that a challenge. I've never felt it as a barrier or an issue, and I've always felt really supported. So I think just the general challenges for me are the same as male and females. I don't think they're different for me. It's just a lot around public perception, I think. You know, we're responsible for an awful lot, but also we're not responsible for an awful lot. And the criminal justice system gets anything that goes wrong tends to be directed towards the police. And actually there's a much bigger, you know, circle of people that form that system. So for me, that's the bit I find the hardest challenge.
I think you're right, that kind of resilience and knowing that you're going to go out there day after day and do your best for victims, for your community, yet still be reading in the paper, on social media, things that have gone wrong, and worrying about how people trust you or think that you will do the right thing, when actually that's integral to our values, and what, you know, our personal values is that we're there to help people, to make the world a better place. And I think that's, you're right, that is probably the most difficult thing, is having that resilience to keep going and keep doing a good job.
I think it's one thing that's probably really hard is with public perception, is that they don't separate the person from the uniform. They see everybody as one uniform, when actually every police force is so different. This is always a question that I want to ask people that ever work in any form of like uniform. But what is like the worst thing that you've ever had, like you've ever witnessed or come across in your time as a police officer?
I think this is a really difficult question to answer, because it's different for everybody. And there will be days when you go and deal with something that you think it hasn't affected you, and then, you know, you'll wake up in the night thinking about whatever that job was. And I've got a number of those that come and haunt me every now and again, because I think, you know, could we have done something different? How could we have saved that person, that child? I think, like Amy, you know, much of my career has been as a detective, and I was a child abuse investigation detective at the very beginning of my career. And I think that was almost the best and the worst job, because you pick up the pieces of a child that's been quite often sexually abused, and you save that child's life. And I've put people in prison for life for doing that kind of awful, awful criminal offences. But yet that can still kind of sit with you for the rest of your life, really. And I've got my own children now, and, you know, sometimes it's really hard to kind of separate the two, and you think of things and you just think, oh, how, you know, I don't know if I could do it anymore at that level, having family of my own. So I think there's always those times that at the time you might not think that it's going to affect you, but it will come back and haunt you later on.
Yeah, similar. My most recent experience has been working in child abuse before going on to this new department. And it's the job that has been the most rewarding, but equally the most heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's the job that I know I made a difference, you know, that and I'll always take that with me. So when you're struggling with what you might have been dealing with, you can go home and think, I know I made a difference to that child's life. And I think in the wider context, the jobs that I've always found the hardest are the suicides that we attend, and dealing with the families. Those are tough.
Yeah. How do you guys compartmentalize, you know, your job and your work that you do?
I think for me, I'm two people almost. I think there's work Amy and there's home Amy. And everyone knows that I'm quite a sensitive soul, and so they're very surprised by the work that I do and how I deal with it. But that's how I see myself. I see, you know, what I do at work is what I do at work, and then I go home and I'm at home.
And I think you have to learn to think through, you know, personally in your own life, how you deal with some of this. So I run, and for me, that's the only time I'm on my own, don't have to talk to anybody, let my thoughts run, get some fresh air. And that absolutely helps me deal with whatever it is I've been thinking about, and then think through the plan of what I'm going to do next and how to carry on and keep going.
Yeah, earlier you said about you know, having a family of your own now probably makes you look at the way you do things differently. Do you find that the work you do does impact your personal life in some way?
Yeah, I think, you know, with having children, you can't help but think, you know, when things happen, you just don't want that to happen to you, or, you know, whether it's an accident or, you know, so I think you do become a little bit more cautious in things, and friends and family may not always understand that, you know, why you're behaving in a certain way or why you're saying, no, they can't do that. And I think it's just what happens.
Yeah,
it?
I think you manage, and you manage risk differently.
Yes.
And, you know, who I choose to look after my children, what I let them do will be very different to some of my friends. And that's fine, but that's just because of what you've seen or dealt with, and your levels of sensitivity are different. So.
Yeah, I can imagine, actually. I think, I mean, it's not quite the same level, but my mum was raised in a naval family, so she's very, very strict, and that impacted what I was able to do. So I can imagine that that's the same with your children, especially, well, the information you guys probably look at. You know, that there's, when we talk about violence against women and girls and things like that, sometimes we do see that a lot of people do come forward and report things, but it doesn't necessarily get taken on it further down the criminal justice system. And, you know, what can we see, what can be done more to help the CPS take on more cases?
But I think the first thing is, you know, we know that many people don't report at all, ever. So we're not actually understanding exactly how much violence against women and girls there is, or indeed any crime, really, because there is under-reporting, but specifically around offences that affect women and girls more significantly. And then it's difficult to investigate violence against women and girls. It's difficult to investigate rape cases, which Amy and colleagues do day in, day out. But that doesn't mean we don't try our best. You know, we are absolutely there for the victim, and we're absolutely there to investigate and make sure that we cover all angles of the investigation. But then there are criminal thresholds that we have to reach in terms of taking a case further down into the court processes. So you have to make sure you've got the right evidence. You have to make sure it's at the right level. And I'm sure we'll go on to talk about what kind of things that looks like. But the reporting to the police is the first step in what is quite a long and protracted investigation. And there are many steps that we have to go through. But you deal with it day in, day out, don't you, Amy?
Reporting is the main thing. I think if someone chooses to report that something has happened to them, the sooner they can report it to us, the more likely we are to be able to capture the evidence we need to take that case through to court, whether that's forensic evidence or CCTV or finding witnesses. The later it is reported to us, the harder or more difficult it is to get that evidence, and the evidence may have gone. So if people can report as soon as they feel strong enough and able to, the sooner they can, the more likely it is we're going to be able to get that evidence that's needed to take the case through to court. That doesn't mean if we've got late reports or historic reports that we can't take those cases to court. It just means it's a little bit harder to build the picture, but that doesn't mean we won't. We'll certainly do our best to try to do that.
What do you guys think are like the barriers to reporting? Like, what stops people wanting to come forward?
A lack of understanding, I think, is probably huge about what the process is, how long it takes. And I think how long it takes is probably one of the biggest hurdles to overcome, or the biggest barrier, because once people, you know, hear about how long it can take, if they decide to report, and it could be months, it could be a year, it could be more than, you know, a year to get through to the end, they feel that perhaps they can't deal with it for that length of time. And I think that's a big barrier to people reporting it to us. There are an awful lot of support services there available to victims of these crimes that we will refer them to, that the SARC will refer them to through the court process. There's even more support there. There are a lot of support services. So I'd encourage people that if they aren't feeling able to report, just to remember that we can provide a lot of support. I know it's one of the most horrific crimes that, you know, could be committed against somebody, and the trauma and the, you know, the way they've got to experience what's happened to them, And it stays with them while that, you know, investigation is ongoing is really, really hard. But there is a lot of support out there.
I think it's also, I mean, we're talking about rape offences here, the support that you could get for a serious sexual assault, or a rape. But I also think there is probably a lack of reporting or a lack of understanding that you can report things like flashing. Or a simple, you know, catcalling harassment in the street. Because what we're finding is, particularly with flashing, that's a crime type that very often will lead to further criminal activity, further sexual offending. It's like a precursor initial crime that some men will do. And I think the more that people recognise that that's not all right and that you should report that, the better, really, because that starts as allowing to look at individuals and where these things are happening, intelligence around them, that kind of thing. So I would encourage not only, you know, if you feel able to report when you've been raped or sexually assaulted, but if you are flashed, come and tell us. Please tell us as much as you can.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things as well that I would never have, I mean, if I got flashed in the street, I'd probably be like, that's horrible. And it would stick with me in some way, but I would never consider reporting it because I feel like it's not worth reporting or it's a waste of police time or like you've got better things to be dealing with. And it wasn't really until I'd actually sat down and spoke to police officers who were actually like, no, people that have gone on to commit more serious offences started off by doing smaller things. And it makes me realise that even the tiniest little bit, like I do have some responsibility to try and stop that before it gets bigger. And it's quite scary to know that like a little thing gets bigger and bigger eventually. But how do you guys go about navigate gathering evidence without potentially re-traumatizing the people that you're helping to like look after?
The way we approach it is when we are dealing with our victims, we have a process that we follow, but it's, you know, every victim and every case is different. But we try to not ask that victim to have to keep repeating what has happened. So we will ask them an initial account, so we know exactly what we're dealing with, when it was, who it was, etc. And then we go on to obtain their evidence, if you like, whether that's in a written statement format or on a visually recorded interview. And in that interview is where we try to get as much of the information as possible and be as detailed as possible so that we have got that evidence and we don't need to keep going back over it again and again. And it's only if through our inquiries that there's, you know, any sort of discrepancies or anything we just need to clear up that we'd have to ask them again. So it's not something we try to keep asking them to repeat. We have, if the case goes to court, we have things called special measures, which a court can grant. So if a victim provides their evidence by a visually recorded interview, that means that they don't have to stand up in court and repeat it. If it's a written statement, then they will be led through their evidence, but that video would get played in court, so the victim wouldn't have to say it again. That's really important, I think, in not re-traumatising the victim. That's the main way, I think, in which we try to do it, try to not get them to having to repeat it time after time after time.
So I guess in that case, in your opinion, why do you think it is that rape or sexual offence cases tend to have low prosecutions in compared to other offences?
They're difficult cases to prosecute. With child offences, they're less difficult, I guess, if you like. Consent isn't usually an issue in child cases. But there's three main points that we need to prove. You know, we need to prove that the victim didn't consent, that the victim didn't have capacity to consent, and that the suspect didn't reasonably believe that they consented. So those are the three things we have to prove, and that can be quite difficult. So that's why we need to look at not just the accounts of the victim and the suspect, but at the bigger picture around the suspect's behaviour leading up to the incident, CCTV evidence, forensic evidence. That's why it's really important to build up the bigger picture. That's probably why I think the cases are just hard to prosecute.
I do get a lot of frequent questions from people that do follow me on social media about these kinds of offences and support that forces can give. One question that I'm always asked time and time again is that whether victims of rape or sexual offences get given, they've asked me an STO, but you've like explained to me off camera that it's a solo. Sorry, what was it again?
The sexual offence liaison officer.
Yeah. So if every victim is assigned someone specific to talk to throughout their time.
So we have a team of solos in Thames Valley Police. We've got obviously quite a high workload and not a huge team. They work really, really hard. So we have to, there's certain criteria, but effectively if you've reported a rape, we're within forensic timescales, you have a solo allocated to you from the very beginning. If you've reported a rape that's happened in the last year, you'll have a solo allocated to you. So there is that level of support from the outset. If they are more historic cases, you'll still have contact from a solo. They'll make sure that you understand the investigation process, that you have any support in place that you need. They'll make any referrals for support, but they're less involved in that case. So yes is the answer, but just at different degrees.
Obviously, we've touched on it briefly about how the media can impact public perception when it comes to policing. And unfortunately, we have seen a lot of cases recently where there are officers that are found to have history or have been abusive to their partners in some way. I guess if for me as a young woman, that's probably could be considered a barrier to wanting to report to the police. You know, what are the consequences for officers that are found to have history of abuse towards their partners or are found to be abusing their partners?
Well, first of all, it's disgraceful. And we all know that there are individuals across the country who've been highlighted recently around what we classify as police perpetrated domestic abuse. The Casey report has just come out last week around culture in the Metropolitan Police. So it's, you know, people are talking about it a lot, and I think it's right that we should. I do not want anybody working in the police service that is a domestic abuser, that commits sexual offences. You wouldn't want that. And we've got to do everything we can to root out those individuals and make sure they're not part of our police service now or in the future. So there's a number of things that are going on. One is around vetting. So every police officer is being re-vetted currently across the country, not just in Thames Valley Police, to make sure that there are no issues in their history that would prevent them from being a police officer. And we have a professional standards department who deal with all concerns and complaints around police officers. And actually, they are looking at not only standards, but also criminal offences. And what we have done here in Thames Valley is we've created a new team within that professional standards department who are focusing on police perpetrated domestic abuse. They have history in dealing with domestic offences from domestic abuse teams. And we're really clear that if we get any reports, they will absolutely be investigated thoroughly. And we will do everything we can to root out those individuals that cause harm. I probably can't reassure you enough, but as the lead for violence against women and girls, the perpetrator focus is so important, and that's out in the communities, but also internally as well. I do not want anybody working with us who has that kind of history or is committing that kind of abuse.
Yeah, I think one of the things as well, this is like a question that I've always thought about. Obviously, you spoke about briefly about the Casey report and about culture. This is a debate that I actually had with my parents about, you know, potentially whistleblowing. Obviously, other officers do see officers' behaviour. They probably know it's not right, but then how can they feel more comfortable to call it out and not have it impact their career?
Yeah, a really important question. And we talk about three things when we're talking about violence against women and girls in policing at the moment. Trust and confidence is the first one. Perpetrator focus is the second. And the third is safer streets. So when you look at trust and confidence, for me, that can be split into the internal trust and confidence within the organisation and the external trust and confidence of the public and our communities. And if you look at the internal trust and confidence, that is about how you create a culture where there are active bystanders. So people do call it out, do step up, do, you know, say that's not acceptable, but also that we create a culture where individuals feel that they can do that at every single level. So whether it's just a comment that's made that you nip in the bud there and then, or, you know, a senior officer or a supervisor says something that you just think that is just not right, we've got the ability as an organisation to say that's okay, to call that out and say that that's not acceptable. So we're doing all sorts in Thames Valley Police. We're, all of our supervisors are engaged in something called healthy team culture training, because we want to make sure people have the skills to be able to lead their teams and have those kind of conversations. And we're also making sure that we invest in our staff really understanding, you know, what has gone on, what the Casey report says, what violence against women and girls strategy says. It's ingrained within our organisation now. Violence against women and girls is a central tenet of our strategy. Our chief constable is adamant that we will do everything we can, and us, you know, as part of that organisation, are doing everything we can to eradicate that. And that starts internally, that starts from within.
Yeah, I think it's really nice to actually, because you don't hear about the positive things that sometimes the police are looking to do internally to kind of change or shift the narrative about the rotten apple. So I think it's probably more reassuring for me personally, and probably anyone that's listening, that to know that there are forces out there that are trying to do things that are really good. And I know that Thames Valley Police are very proactive in their approach to violence against women and girls. I was really fortunate to be on a night shift as part of Project Vigilant. That's kind of like where our relationship started. And I think it was a massive eye-opener to know that there are, you know, you guys are trained on things that I would never even think of, and that you are actively looking for it as opposed to just, you know, waiting for something to happen and then dealing with it then. How did Project Vigilant start?
So Project Vigilant started actually in 2019. So before there was the kind of national recognition that, around violence against women and girls, we recognised that there was an increase in sexual violence in the nighttime economy in Oxford. So around the nighttime, you know, pubs and clubs, big student, vibrant city, and we'd start to see a rise in sexual offences and rapes, and we weren't happy about that. So a group of people started to consider, how can we do something different here? And this is not about focusing on the victim. This is about focusing on the offender, the perpetrator. So Project Vigilant was set up, and Project Vigilant is where we use officers who are plainclothes and officers who are in uniform out together in the nighttime economy. And we train them up. So they have got extra training around behaviours, and behaviours that they are looking for are those that perpetrators of sexual violence will use. So I can't obviously go into the detail of what we train them or how we train them, but they have had extra kind of behavioral analytical training. And they'll go out in the nighttime economy and they'll be around in the streets, and you won't see them because they're in plain clothes, and you'll see your uniformed officers as normal wandering around. And they will pick out the people that they think are a concern. So, you know, you and I might say, there's a weirdo just stood on the street corner. He's a bit iffy. We're not going to walk that way. And so you have that kind of general feelings about people sometimes, don't you? But our officers will pick out that person, but also other people that they'll watch and go, they're you know, following every girl that comes out. They're just doing things that are not quite right. And our uniformed officers will be called in to intervene, and they will stop check that person. They will check their details. And what we found, scarily, is 20% or one in five individuals that we stop has got some sort of sexual offending history. They've either been arrested for a sexual offence, or they've got some sort of domestic abuse in their background. So they are out there, and they are there to actively perpetrate. And what we've done is put Vigilant out in Oxford. We've now spread it to all towns and our cities in Thames Valley, and we're seeing reductions in that kind of nighttime economy sexual violence. And what's brilliant is that it's being seen as national good practice. So there's a lot of money that's being invested by the College of Policing to review what we're doing, with a view to sharing it nationally, so that, you know, wherever you go out on a night out in whatever town across the country, you can be reassured that there are police officers out there watching out for you.
There's a question I did get actually when I first shared my experience of being part of Project Vigilant or witnessing Project Vigilant, is that obviously we've had some cases where plain-clothed officers or officers that should be in uniform having stopped people.
Yeah.
And I think that was a major concern for some of the women that follow me on social media. They ask, you know, how do I know that they are part of Project Vigilant and they're not just stopping me because they're plain-clothed? Am I correct in saying that a plain-clothed officer will never intervene unless it's
On Project Vigilant, you're absolutely right. So our plainclothes officers are out of sight and they won't intervene. It is our uniformed officers that will come in and will deal with it. I mean, this stems back from the awful murder of Sarah Everard by, I don't even want to say his name, the individual from the Metropolitan Police who used his warrant card, wasn't on duty, was in plainclothes. That doesn't happen in Project Vigilant, but just to reassure people, you can, if you get stopped by a police officer, they should always show you their warrant card, and you are always able to contact 999 or 101 and verify who they are. And if they don't let you do that, then, you know, shout and call for help. We would always say, if you're stopped by me, if you're stopped by a male, doesn't matter, check that their warrant card is there, check which force they're from, and you are absolutely able to call in.
If you were in a situation where you felt immediately in danger, obviously we've seen advice from people where you've been asked to flag down a bus, for example, what would you say to do if you felt like you were in immediate danger and ringing in wasn't an option?
Yeah, I mean, officers should have their warrant card. They should have a radio if they're out and about on duty. And you can ask them to speak to control room. You know, there may be a reason that you're being arrested because there may be suspicion of a criminal offence. And clearly there is the law that allows us to arrest individuals, whether you're a man or a woman, depending on what the circumstances are. I think if you're really worried, and the officer is not letting you call in 999 or 101 or, you know, speak to the control room on the radio with them, then for me that is problematic. And I do think you need to, you know, ask for help if you can. Ask somebody else for help. Ask other individuals to call 999 on your behalf if that's an opportunity to do so. So I would hope that there will never be that kind of experience. I think it's very, very rare. But I do think if you are so uncomfortable and you just think this is not right, then you have to do what you need to do to order to get some help and just to check out what's going on.
I think it's really nice to know that there are proactive measures in place when it comes to policing. But obviously, Amy, you mentioned earlier about victim support, and I think that people don't really realise, and I was one of those people because I grew up in the Thames Valley jurisdiction and I never knew that the sexual assault referral centres existed or ways that victims could get support. And I've been very unfortunate in a sense that I know people that have been assaulted and probably would have benefited knowing that those support systems existed. You know, when I first visited the SARC, it's really weird to say pleasantly surprised, because my only experience of the SARC outside of conversations with you guys or the force in general is TV dramas where it looks like the woman is basically on a butcher's table and it's just loads of uniformed officers everywhere and it's very clinical and it's very scary. And I remember watching it thinking, I would never want to put myself in that situation had I been assaulted, because you would feel like you're being assaulted again. How different is the SARC and the support that victims get in real life different to media?
Quite different, I think, is probably the answer to that. If anyone has to go to a SARC, we know that's going to be a really, really difficult experience for them, no matter what the SARC looks like or how it is. So there are people trained at the SARC, the right people there who know, will do their very best to reassure and comfort people that are there. We have the crisis workers there, and then the nurse or the doctor, depending on who's called out. There's a point where, you know, we're trying to capture evidence as well forensically. So, you know, there are certain processes that have to be followed, which may seem very clinical in a sense, but that's not the overarching idea of the SARC, is that it's a support service there to enable victims to have any forensic evidence captured, to be referred to the right support services, whether that's through counselling or sexual health. So it is pretty different, I think. It's just a difficult experience, no matter how it appears, though, I think.
Yeah, I think obviously when I was there, I learned about it from the crisis workers' perspective and what they do. But they're obviously not in a position to tell me about what it's like on your side and how you guys come in. So, you know, I did get to see the forensic room, how they collate evidence. And it was really important that they reiterated that it doesn't necessarily 100% guarantee that you're going to report to the police if you don't want to. But even if you don't want to report to the police, like, what's the time, what's the best way or best timing for me to be able to go to the SARC after assault?
It's back to my, probably the very first answer I gave is, if you feel able as soon as possible, you know, that's where we can capture the best forensic evidence. And even if you choose at that point not to then report it to the police, that evidence has been captured. The SARC will keep hold of that for 2 years. So you have a period of 2 years before they get to the point where they need to then, you know, have destroy it. So as soon as possible is the answer, but we know it's not always that easy. There's no cut off, you know, if you need to report it, but as soon as possible.
Obviously, there is an element of forensic evidence when it comes to any sort of sexual offence, but obviously the forensic evidence can give so much. It can prove that sexual activity took place, but not necessarily that it was unconsensual. And I think one thing you always hear about a lot, even in like TV dramas, I know I hate referring back to TV dramas when it comes to policing because they're so different, but I think one, people are always conscious of like what other forms of evidence can be taken to help prove your case when it comes to the criminal route of a sexual offence.
There's so much, really. You know, there's CCTV evidence, there's witness accounts, whether that's friends of or people who may not even be friends, people that have been around the victim, that have been around the suspect. There's digital evidence on mobile phones, computers, tablets, around any possible conversations that have been had, around locations, that kind of thing. House-to-house inquiries, ring doorbell footage. You know, there's all sorts of other evidence, because as you say, forensic evidence doesn't always prove the case. You know, if the suspect's admits that there was sexual activity, that may not assist us in proving the offence. So we always have to look at the whole picture, not just forensics. That's just one strand of it.
I think people are always conscious of whether police use mobile phones as, or like mobile phone activity as part of the investigation. What is the likelihood that that is part of it?
With the amount of contact people have nowadays, and you know, the use of mobile phones for via all sorts of means, whether it's social media, WhatsApp, text messages, emails, it's quite likely that there may be evidence that's relevant to the offence, whether that's been where the person's been before, or conversations they've had, or something they've said afterwards. So it's quite likely that we may find evidence on digital devices, whether that's the victims or the suspects. But to take a victim's mobile phone is such a big thing, you know.
Yeah.
Generally all our lives are on our mobile phones now. So to say I'm going to take it, you know, you'd be kind of lost with that. I don't know anyone's number, I can't. So we aim that if we really do need to take the victim's mobile phone, obviously we only do it if the victim is willing to pass us the phone, and we try to make sure we return it within 24 hours. We'll book it in on a particular date and time that works for the victim, so they can sort of plan ahead that they're not going to have the phone that day. We can offer a replacement handset in that period if they need it. And to reassure people, we don't go through everything on the phone. We specifically look for what the information that either from the victim or elsewhere we think is relevant to the offence. It's not just to have a look through everyone's conversations. If the victim says that there's been a WhatsApp conversation between her and him or her, or the suspect, that's the only thing we're looking for. We're not looking at everything else. So just to reassure people, it's not a phishing exercise. It's specifically looking for what evidence we think is on there.
When we talk about the suspect, for example, when we talk about the suspect, I know that in quite a lot of cases of sexual offences, quite a lot of the time the victim may know the perpetrator or the suspect. And I think that it does cause a bit of a barrier in terms of reporting, because then you don't want to upset the people around you and then get pressured into, like, you know, peer pressure in general. What actually happens to the suspect when it goes through the criminal proceedings?
So the suspect would be arrested as soon as possible. That would always be our aim, again, to try and capture that early evidence so we don't lose any evidence. You know, victims may go through the forensic process themselves. That can also happen with suspects when they're in custody. They can have swabs and samples taken. they will have their phone looked at. They will, you know, the process, we will do as much as we can in relation to securing evidence from the suspect to be as least intrusive on the victim as we can. So if we think there's something on the suspect's phone, maybe we can just take it from the suspect's phone and don't need the victim's phone. Everything can seem to happen quite quickly at the very beginning, with arrests being made, with perhaps forensic and detective searches at the scene of the incident, evidence being secured by whatever means. In some cases, we would seek to keep the suspect in custody. We'd be contacting the Crown Prosecution Service and seeking to charge and remand the suspect in certain cases. In the majority of cases, the suspect would be bailed to allow all the other inquiries to be done around digital forensic evidence and so on, and liaising with the Crown Prosecution Service. And that's the point where it can feel like I think it slows down a little bit. You know, there's that initial flurry of activity and contact. And then when samples are submitted for analysis and phones are being downloaded, it slows down and it takes some time. We'd endeavour to put bail conditions in place to try to protect the victim from any contact from the suspect, keep the victim regularly updated on what's happening, on the progress of the investigation. The Crown Prosecution Service, if a case gets submitted to them, they will also write a letter to the victim to let them know that the case is now with them and they're reviewing it. So it should be lots of regular updates, although it can feel like it slows down at points.
But that's like normal. So it's not just that the case has gone cold. It's just...
No, it's, you know, it takes time for the inquiries to come back. You know, when things are submitted, it takes time to come back. The officers will often seek advice from the Crown Prosecution Service at an early stage and agree what further inquiries need to be done to build that case. It's completely normal. It's just it can take some time to get everything completed.
How does the SARC support Thames Valley Police in terms of its reportings and criminal routes?
We've got a very close working relationship. We've got two SARCs in Thames Valley, and we do use other SARCs out of force if necessary. We have regular meetings with them, so we understand any issues, any barriers that they have, and we can try and address those. But they're really important in building the trust and confidence, I think, with our victims that if they're not ready to report, or even if they are ready to report, either way, that there is somewhere they can go where they can have the right support put in place for them. They can have their evidence captured there and then, and that can work towards, if they feel they want to report it, building a case against the suspect.
If I ever wanted to report any form of sexual offence, what is the best route for me to do that?
You've got a variety of options, ways you can report it. You can ring 101 and make the report that way if you want to report directly to the police. Obviously go by the SARC route that we've discussed. We've also got online reporting now. Some victims find it hard to talk about initially, so we now have online reporting, which can be specifically for sexual offences. So people may feel more able to write it down initially, know they've made that step, and then we will contact them to discuss it further. If any offences are reported to the police, we will facilitate the SARC process. So it's not, you know, an either or, you know, we will make sure that happens as part of the investigation. They're just sort of two different routes into reporting.
I really wanted to know actually a little bit more about the recruitment side of policing. I know that for me, I went to an all-girls school and I didn't feel like there was a lot of conversation about recruitment for female officers. But obviously, the police have to represent the people that they serve, right? So, you know, what would be bits of advice that you could give to young women that are listening that want to join the police force?
Well, I would say, yeah, the public are the police and the police are the public. Absolutely. That's key. I think it's a brilliant job. We have nearly 50-50% in terms of our recruitment now, women to men. There are loads of opportunities. There is nothing to stop you, whether you're male or female, in terms of the roles that you can do. So, you know, we have women on our firearms teams. We have women who are running public order events. I'm a strategic firearms commander. So I'm there, you know, running firearms operations, running public order operations. You can be a detective, you can be on the horses, you can be on the helicopter, you can be on response. There is such a plethora of roles And it, you know, it doesn't really matter what you want to do. You can have a whole career doing a variety of different things, which is what I love about it so much. And you get to see the best and the worst of society, and you get to help people in their time of need. And you know, people will always come to us for help, and that's what we're here for.
Yeah, I think for me, I remembered this when we were talking. When I was at school, a female police officer came into school. She was our school's liaison officer, and she was my, like, that's who I want to be. You know, I think as people meet people along the way, they think, actually, yeah, I could do that. And I think if it's something that people are interested in, just go for it. It is an amazing career.
I think when I was young, you know, you always have kids that are like, oh, I want to be a police officer when I grow up. I always wanted to be a dog handler because I love dogs, but the way I look after my dog, I'd be too soft. Like, that dog would probably get overweight and just not be as strict as
they're
it
really
should be.
They're really scary, our police dogs.
Yeah, so. Yeah, they
I
are,
wouldn't
want to
go anywhere near them. Yeah.
But like, I just know that I'd want to cuddle it and stuff, and you can't do that with a police dog. So evidently that career route
was not
for me.
Although we do have a very nice well-being dog who's very fluffy and lovely. Yeah.
But you can't join the force for a well-being dog.
No.
That would go down like a sack of spuds in the interview. Why don't you be a police officer? I've heard you've got a well-being dog, so that's why I'm here. But I think it's I actually think it's really nice that I got to speak to both of you, because again, like, I felt like there wasn't that many female officers in my time when I was at school, so I didn't have that person to be like, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And I think that was a shame, because, you know, I had a really big interest in law, and it could have been a route that I ended up down if I'd had potentially had that contact when I was younger. So hopefully, like, people listening to your experiences and seeing, like, the amazing work that you guys do as officers has helped inspire them. I actually always ask people the final question about people that doubt people's successes based on the fact they're women. But what would you say to people that doubt your successes based on the fact you're long-term serving police officers and women police officers?
What would I say? I think, you know, throughout policing over the last 23 years I've been in the police, there have been some really inspirational women leaders. Absolutely. And there are some real, and when I say leaders, I don't just mean at the top. You know, police officers at all ranks lead in their communities through traumatic, terrible times. I don't think it matters whether you're a man or a woman. I think if you want to do it, come and join us, come and see what it's like, come and be a special constable if you don't want to do it full time, come on a ride along, come and be a volunteer, come and test the waters. And I think, you know, you can't doubt people on the basis of their gender. You doubt them on the basis of their performance. And you see fabulous women doing fabulous work day in, day out, and that should be enough.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's about the person. And for any job that we attend, it's whether they're male or female officer that attends, it's the person you're going to remember, how they dealt with you, how they responded to you, how, if they were empathetic or not. It's not the gender, it's the person. Judge them on that.
And I would actually definitely recommend the ride along or like observing, because I think that was like one of the most eye-opening experiences I've ever had to do, though the blues and twos probably did not do well for my car sickness. So again, probably another reason why I'd make a terrible police officer. But honestly, thank you both so much. Well, not just for being on my podcast in the studio, but for everything you do in your job. Like, I know it's not easy, but obviously we wouldn't be able to put these people behind bars if it wasn't people like you. So I really appreciate everything you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really wanted to be a dog handler because I love German Shepherds, but how I look after my dog, there is no way that I could look after a police dog.
Yeah, you can.
Could, if you make that as a role, please hit me up.
No, there is a role.
Is it?
You can have the German Shepherds as a baby. Yeah. We'll sign
I'm joining
you up.
The police.
You have to be a volunteer. Yeah, police volunteer.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.